Now let's take a moment to reflect on a woman who was famous for overcoming adversity. Actress Patricia Neal has died of lung cancer. She was known for sad and longing eyes and for the husky voice she used on stage and in movies.
I'll give you up now, myself, rather than watch you being destroyed by a world where you have no chance.
In 1964, she won an Oscar for her role as a tough housekeeper in HUD with Paul Newman.
If you think I've been nipping at it, I don't drink anything but Tokay wine.
Yeah, and I'll bet you keep your little finger crooked while you're doing it.
Why don't you go stick your head in the water trough and sober up for lunch?
Just a year after that starring role, Neal suffered multiple strokes, leaving her in a coma, semi-paralyzed and unable to walk and talk. But she learned to walk, talk, and act again. She survived and lived until age 84. It's NPR News.
We're going to hear now what it means to look for help for mental health problems in India. There aren't a lot of mental health professionals in India. A new study shows there's one psychiatrist for every 400,000 people. It means that most people in India go untreated for substance abuse problems, severe depression, and psychotic disorders. Or at least they're not treated by doctors. Some turn to the gods. In the first of two reports on mental health in India, Miranda Kennedy traveled to a temple in southern India where many people believe that the mentally ill can be healed.
The Hanumattapuram temple is always packed with worshippers. They travel from across India for days and weeks by bullock cart and on foot to get to this lush rural part of Tamil Nadu. They come because the powerful Hindu deity who lives here, an incarnation of Shiva, is supposed to purge evil spirits. Dama Lakshmi is a tough, wiry woman in her 60s who talks non-stop, even as she slurps her plastic cup of chai, squatting on her haunches. She says that several years ago, evil spirits possessed her daughter, Manamagali. Her husband kicked her out, and with her mother, she moved into the temple to wait to be cured. Manamagali's eyes are glazed over. Her mother says she often chants in a language she can't understand.
She just started behaving very weirdly, and I believe it is because of evil magic. She will talk very filthy language and laugh to herself a lot.
Faith healers and temple doctors are by far the most socially acceptable way to try to cure mental illness in India. There's hardly any psychiatrists and a mere 37 mental institutions to serve the country's whole population of 1.2 billion. But even if there were more professionals, it might not matter. Psychiatrists compete not with each other, but with healers and gurus. Every morning at dawn, Manamagali files inside the temple with a group of somber, trance-like women. The women's saris are grubby, and many of them have allowed their hair to mat into dreadlocks, which is unheard of in a country where neatness is prized. A priest draws back the curtain covering the idol of Shiva, and the women start to shriek and wail. It's as though the image of the god is actually bringing out their psychosis. They throw their bodies against the temple walls and beat themselves with their fists. The temple priest forbade us from recording the loudest and most disturbing scenes. Porkati, a social worker who goes by only one name, describes it this way.
Each one gets into a trance. One is screaming, one is just shaking all over, one is rolling on the floor, and the bells are ringing. I've seen people calling the deity filthy names also. This fit happens for about half an hour, and it subsides.
Porkati, the social worker, comes here a lot. She spends hours trying to cajole the mentally ill to visit a nearby psychiatric clinic. After she convinced Manamagali to go, the doctor told her she was schizophrenic, but her mother didn't have the money to keep paying for the antipsychotics he prescribed. In any case, she felt more comfortable dealing with the gods. Porkati sees that a lot.
People find it easier to say that their children or themselves are affected because of evil magic, because there's so much of stigma attached to mental illness. So in Hindi there is a saying, dawa bhi chahiye, dua bhi chahiye. Dawa is your medicines, dua is your prayers. So a bit of both only will help.
India's official medical establishment does not agree with the bit of both theory. It wants nothing to do with traditional healers. But there are mental health professionals who are more flexible about it. Chris Fairburn is a professor of psychiatry at Oxford University who helps fund mental health programs in India. After taking a tour of rural hospitals along bumpy roads in Tamil Nadu, he says it seems unrealistic to ignore how pervasive temple doctors are.
I think those of us who are interested in trying to work out how to deliver good mental health care to countries where there's very limited resources, we should think about what resources are there. We don't have to approve of them or necessarily condone what they do, but we should acknowledge their existence and try and find out what they do.
Every day in India, medicine must do battle with religion. In Hanumattapuram Temple, it's pretty clear which one wins. After the morning ritual, the resident exorcist makes a dramatic entrance to the temple wearing a saffron sari. Her face is painted with red and yellow powder, and she proudly wields a three-pronged spear to intimidate evil spirits. Only she is able to reach the god who resides in this temple, she tells Dama Lakshmi. She makes her an offer. She'll expel the spirits from her daughter for the impossible price of $150. For NPR News, I'm Miranda Kennedy.
The Muslim holy month of Ramadan begins this week, which means the faithful will be fasting from dawn to dusk. The idea is for Muslims to reflect on what it's like to go hungry and to share food and charity with those less fortunate. It's also a time for celebrating with family and friends, especially in Egypt, which boasts Ramadan traditions that are unique in the Muslim world. Still, as NPR Soraya Sarhadi Nelson reports, some think the holy month has become an exercise in excess.
Ahmad Sunni and his apprentice work on brightly colored tin and glass lanterns, thousands of which are for sale along this narrow medieval street in Cairo. To Sunni, nothing heralds the holy month of Ramadan more than these lanterns. Called fanus in Arabic, they are lit with candles or bulbs and are displayed in doorways and on balconies across Egypt. Sunni's employer, Magdi Abul Azab, says he has a growing clientele outside Egypt who've adopted his nation's lantern tradition, most recently from Libya. His workers can barely keep up with the demand, crafting about 50 lanterns every day that cost from $1 to $700. But their work will grind to a halt when the fasting month begins, highlighting another less desirable tradition here called the Ramadan effect. Each year, the Egyptian economy slumps during the holy month. Workdays are cut short and production and stock performance drop. At the same time, public consumption skyrockets, meaning more imports. Some of the additional goods go to the needy like Islam prescribes. Colorful tents packed with free food are set up all over Cairo by private individuals and charities. But unbridled feasting goes on at home, too, says political sociologist Saeed Sadek.
We have 30 days of Christmas Eve, full of banquets and food. Egypt consumes three times its normal food consumption during the months of Ramadan.
Sadek says Egyptians also sit glued to their televisions on Ramadan nights, watching the numerous soap operas and historical dramas unveiled here during this time of year.
And so the people, for 1 month, they are semi-drugged by media, by food, banquets that are being held, you know, because religion advises that it is better that people eat together.
This year, the Egyptian government has added a new twist, declaring it is turning back clocks just for Ramadan. That way, people end their fast an hour earlier than they would otherwise. Daylight savings will return once Ramadan ends. The time change makes spice salesman Hossam Adin Mohammed uncomfortable. He wonders why Egypt is the only country creating a time zone for the holiday. Mohammed said he hopes it doesn't violate Islamic law. Still, he's certain he and other Egyptians celebrate Ramadan the way the Prophet Muhammad intended.
Of course we eat a lot, but that's part of the family spirit. One night it's at my place, the next night at my sister's, and another night at my mother-in-law's house.
Even the more conservative religious groups support the Egyptian festivities. Ali Abdul Fattah is a spokesman for the Muslim Brotherhood, a political movement which is officially banned in Egypt.
Certainly our message to Egyptians during Ramadan is no excessive food and no excessive partying or staying up way too late, because that's hated by Islam.
But he says he feels Egyptians are more pious during Ramadan now than in years gone by. Fetah says even the belly dancers who used to dance for tourists during Ramadan now abstain. He says instead they sponsor food tents for the poor on the streets. Soraya Sarhadi Nelson, NPR News, Cairo.
As it happens, Egypt is now one of many countries considered vulnerable to food shortages. Grain prices are climbing. That's a consequence of a drought and massive wildfires in the countryside of Russia. It's a global market for grain, so a problem in one place affects every place. Wheat prices have risen by almost 70% since June. Some people in southern European countries could face trouble, and those countries have already had severe cuts in social services because of a budget crisis. An analyst says the Middle East and North Africa, especially Egypt, may also face danger.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It's possible to look at many of the problems the United States faces today, Iraq, Afghanistan, the Middle East, and Iran, and find a common thread, Islam. Since September the 11th, some argue that we are engaged in a conflict with radical Islamists that some describe as the Long War. Former intelligence officer Graham Fuller proposes that we look at these challenges in a different way. Would the world be very different if Islam never existed? He argues that the long and difficult relationship between the West and the Middle East has less to do with religion and more to do with disputes over land, resources, politics, and power. To what degree do the conflicts in the Middle East focus on religion? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the program, Ron Galella, the godfather of the paparazzi, joins us. But first, Graham Fuller, former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA, former senior political scientist at the Rand Corporation. His new book is called A World Without Islam and joins us now from a studio in Squamish, British Columbia. And nice to have you today on Talk of the Nation.
Hi, Neil. Thank you.
And I wanted to make things clear from the beginning. Your title could be misinterpreted. You are in no way advocating a world without Islam.
No, absolutely not. I'm really focusing on the nature of struggle between the East and the West and whether Islam plays a significant role in that.
And you argue that, in fact, it doesn't get counterfactual history. Is that what you're writing here?
Well, it's a kind of act of historical imagination. I try to run through a whole lot of events and take Islam out of the equation and see what we're left with. And it's kind of astonishing that you find deep-rooted conflicts that that still exist over ethnicity or economics or warfare or armies or geopolitics or whatever that really don't have anything to do with Islam and indeed existed long before Islam came into existence.
And in fact, there were conflicts between East and West in antiquity before Islam existed.
That's correct. I mean, if you look at the ancient Greeks fought wars with the ancient Persians for several hundred years from about 500 to 300 B.C., struggling over the same turf, and the people who came to occupy them later, the Byzantine Christians fought the same wars, and then the Turkish Muslims came and they fought the same wars. So you just find a very interesting kind of continuity of geopolitics and grievances across the region that don't need Islam to explain it. Islam is a banner. It's a great banner. Religions are great banners if you want to propagate your cause. But don't confuse the banner with the issues at heart.
Yet Islam was also an organizing principle of an empire that exploded out of Arabia in the 7th century and came to, dominate much of the world, to conquer Spain and right to the gates of Vienna.
Well, that's true. On the other hand, it was fascinating how relatively easy the Muslim conquest was. And one fascinating reason here, Neil, is that the Islamic vision of Jesus was that he was a great prophet with an all-time message for Muslims as well, but he was not literally the Son of God. This was what Christians were arguing about for hundreds of years in that part of the world, as to what was the exact nature of Jesus, and was he man or was he God, or 50-50, or all of those things. So by the time Islam came along and said, okay, this is our take on it, it was hardly a surprise. It was more a sort of administrative change of power at the top than theological.
Yet, again, it can't be argued that the Muslim empire that took over much part of the world could ever have been possible without some organizing principle, and indeed that principle was Islam.
Absolutely, and I agree with you, and that's not the point that I'm arguing. I'm not arguing that Islam has not had great impact on the Middle East region and its cultures and civilization. I mean, it's had a glorious civilization in its day. But I'm arguing that the nature of conflict between the West and the East does not depend on that and precedes Islam and would still exist if you took away, you know, I mean, for example, struggles over oil and energy in the area. If the area were Christian, would the region be any more accepting of big Western oil companies trying to come in and dominate those things? I don't think so.
You also point out the example of the Middle East conflict, sometimes portrayed as a three-sided conflict between Christians and Jews and Muslims. Nevertheless, if you said all of those Muslims were Christian, they would have been no more accepting of the state of Israel.
Well, that's right. And, I mean, the whole Arab-Israeli thing has nothing to do with Islam, really, because the Jews who had suffered incredible persecution in Europe and slaughter and discrimination and culminating in the Holocaust ended up migrating to Palestine to get away from all of that and displaced Palestinians who were living there. But I don't, you know, if those Palestinians were Muslim or Christian or Buddhist or whatever, it was still their land and there would have still been the same resentments in the struggle to regain their state.
But there are, as you know, those who will argue that Islam is a fundamentally violent religion that calls on a forced conversion, among other things.
Well, that I think you know is really very inaccurate. Forced conversion. There's a line in the Quran explicitly saying that no force in religion. So, this is not to say that various religions at various times in history have not broken their own commandments. Certainly Christian armies, Muslim armies, other armies have done the same. But essentially that is not considered to be a correct form of Islam.
One of the great tensions between the East and West to this day are those series of military expeditions known as the Crusades. Do you think Europeans would have been as eager to be traveling to that part of the world had not the Holy Land been held by what they regarded as infidels?
Well, yeah, that's really a fascinating question, because I think the Crusades, in our eyes in the West, are the sort of preeminent example of cultural conflict. But, you know, it's interesting that that Jerusalem fell to Muslims sometime in the 7th century, and it was only about 500 years later that suddenly they decided in Europe to have Crusades over the whole thing. And this was when Europe found itself with mercenary armies that had used to be fighting against German barbarians and others for years were marauding all over the place, and the Pope needed to get all this energy and out of the way. So there were economic and there were political and there were cultural and social reasons for that crusade to start. But hey, we talked about Islam as a banner. Christianity was a glorious banner for what ended up being an invasion of the East, establishment of city-states run by Christians, and even the sacking of Christian Constantinople itself at that time. So, you know, you can easily take Islam out of that and find pretty similar events.
And indeed, in the course of human events, you argue that had Islam not been there, the Western powers in their interests, or what they regarded as their interests, would have found something else to crusade about.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you start moving outside of Europe for areas to conquer, you can only go east to Russia, and Europeans did, or they could go south and east to the Middle East, and that's why this area has been a classic grounds of clash between east and west. But I think Western, you know, expansionism, the whole colonial and imperial movements in 18th, 19th century, all of that would have gone on. Europeans didn't care whether they were invading and taking over Christian countries, Buddhist countries, Muslim countries, whatever. They went there and colonized and ran them and created huge legacies of resentment and sparking wars of national liberation. So nothing special, specially religious there, except, again, Islam was a great banner for many Muslims who were struggling against French or English or Dutch or other forms of foreign European imperialism.
And you focus on the Western depredations into Islamic lands. Nevertheless, this does cut both ways.
Yes, but I think if you – the number of times when you find what Eastern armies coming into the West – I mean, the Ottoman Empire got up to the gates of Vienna at one point and were repulsed, and they were in Spain for a very long period of time, by the way, which was one of the high points of Christian-Jewish-Muslim cooperation, very high civilization. But apart from that, it was mostly the other way around. The West by then was getting much stronger and able to send its armies there. And, you know, I mean, Neil, in terms of violence, it's interesting to consider the really most hideous killings of human beings in the history of humanity took place in the 20th century and largely driven by Europeans who started World War I, World War II, kicked these conflicts all around the world, Marxism and Leninism, Hitler, Stalin, you know, not even any religion in all of this. It was much of it. It was atheist, imperial drive in which million, you know, maybe up to 100 million people killed in all of those events. So,
including some in the Middle East, though both conflicts, the Middle East was something of a sideshow.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the Europeans carried their war to the Middle East and wanted various states to line up with them against the Germans or against later in the Cold War against the Russians. But, you know, you're hard put to find anything remotely in the annals of Islam that show the numbers of people butchered as were butchered in the 20th century by Western Europeans. Now, look, I'm not saying that Western Europeans are inherently more evil. They are not. Nobody is inherently more evil. But they created and developed and perfected the weapons of mass destruction going back hundreds of years, which gave them an advantage in the ability to impose their authority absolutely on most of the rest of the world. And that's still true.
Industrialized the means of mass killing.
Exactly.
And we're talking with Graham Fuller about his most recent book, A World Without Islam. When we come back from a short break, we'll be taking your phone calls. We wanted to find out what you think about the thesis. Would the world be different, largely different, if Islam had never existed? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And also you can join the conversation at our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. We'll also be talking with Graham Fuller about the implications of his thesis for U.S. foreign policy going into the future. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking with Graham Fuller about his book, A World Without Islam. You can dig into what Fuller describes as the Immaculate Conception Theory of Crises Abroad in an excerpt from his book at our website. Go to npr.org, click on Talk of the Nation. You can also join the conversation. Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Let's go to Drew. Drew's on the line with us from Richmond.
Hi, I was just wondering if you guys could discuss the legacy of colonialism in the Middle East, specifically the Sykes-Picot Agreement, and how the borders that were drawn weren't necessarily sustainable to the people of the Middle East and weren't drawn regarding their best interests.
Graham Fuller, a situation that not only pertains to the Middle East, but to much of Africa as well.
Exactly. I mean, this is one of the many legacies. I think Drew put his finger right on it. One of the many legacies of Western imperialism was not only to conquer and occupy and control most of the rest of the world for long periods of time, but to redraw the boundaries, and that has created problems and legacies we're still living with. I mean, the Arab world in particular was divided up very, very artificially along lines that were more reflective of agreements between British and French interests than they were with the populations who lived there or the ethnic or tribal makeup of it. So that is what the region is still studying with, somewhat artificial states, and then run by dictators who were established by the West, who were perceived as pro-Western and pliable to Western interests. So though that's still a burning issue and has not changed in a number of Middle Eastern countries today.
But, and I'm not going to argue with that, but to go back just a little bit further, it's important not to overlook the effect of the previous empire in the region, that's the Ottomans.
Well, that's true. It's interesting that the major region in which opposition came to the Ottoman Empire was in the Balkans, and that was an area that was largely Christian, either Orthodox or Catholic, and they didn't get along, by the way, particularly well. But in terms of the broader Muslim world, there was not a great deal of revolt. There were periodic dissatisfactions, but most Muslims felt that they were part of a greater empire, Muslim empire, one of the biggest in the history. So they were fairly content to be part of it. Later on, nationalism developed. You had Arab nationalism, Turkish nationalism. These are Western ideas that I'm not sure have really helped the region to unify when you have ethnic groups at each other's throats.
Drew, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you very much.
Let's go next to this is Pete. Pete with us from Cleveland.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Just a quick question. You know, as far as the conflicts, would the world be different without Islam? You know, I don't believe so. Religion is religion. But that being said, we're currently in two wars, Iraq and Afghanistan. We're trying to stop threats against the United States from the Muslim world. Out of all the programs I've heard on this topic, the Middle East and everything that goes along with that, no one's ever asked a question or answered, why is there such disdain from that part of the world towards the United States, and what would we as the United States have to do to get that part of the world or the people behind, the attacks and what they want to do to us, to leave us alone?
Well, that's a great question, and I think most Muslims would say, leave us alone, because history, I think we in the U.S. tend to think of history as beginning with 9/11. But there's a long, long history, even of U.S., I'm not talking about just European, but of U.S. involvement in the region as well, that goes that would be seen as a blank check for anything that Israel wants to do in the region, would be seen as seizure of oil, propping up of dictators, supporting anybody that's anti-American, overthrowing regimes. There's a long list of all of this. So the region would say, stay out of our area, leave us alone, let us try to build our own states. But now it's not only just intervention, it's warfare with hundreds of thousands of people being killed, creating resentments, rage. It's supporting the most extremist elements. Now, this is a God-given event for Osama bin Laden, who saw these wars as the quickest way to win support of the local population in this so-called struggle against American imperialism. So the short answer is, rather than us telling them to get out of our face, they would be telling us the same. Get out of our area. Leave us alone.
If we were to leave Iraq and Afghanistan and purchase their oil on the free market but still maintain our support of Israel, would that be a means to an end? Or is it the fact that, we just stand behind Israel, kind of like the 51st state, that causes all the problems?
Well, I don't think it's the existence of Israel. I mean, almost nobody at this point, no rational people in the Middle East are saying that Israel doesn't exist or shouldn't exist. But they do want a settlement to the Palestinian problem and occupation of Palestine that's been going on since 1967. I mean, this is over 40 years now. This is one of the longest occupations ever. But apart from that, if we could get that problem settled fairly and not simply taking Israel's side, then I think slowly, bit by bit, you'd find the area definitely calming down. There's all kinds of ways in which we could spend a fraction of the money that's being spent on losing wars to improve the, you know, health, schooling, education, all of these things, which I think would transform the area.
Pete? Why can't
Pete, we want to give somebody else a chance. Pete, we want to give somebody else a chance. Thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it. Here's an email from Jason in San Francisco. The issue is not conflict with Islam as an abstract. The issue is a religious belief system that actively promotes suicidal attacks on noncombatants as a path to heaven.
Well, again, this is an issue that has come up a great deal. There is the Quran prohibits suicide. There is debate among Muslims among radical Muslims as to whether suicide in the name of national defense is legitimate or not. But what's really fascinating here, Jason, is that suicide bombing is a really, really recent event. There had been no suicide bombings against the U.S. and really until the war in Lebanon, when the U.S. Marines went in 1980s. The suicide bombing then was brand new to Iraq. That had never begun until the American invasion there. And then only in recent years have we begun to see it in Afghanistan. So we're talking about something really new in the history of Islamic fighting. And just let me finish that point by quoting Yasser Arafat, who used to be the head of the Palestinian PLO, who said, you know, if you guys will sell us F-16s, we'd be happy to give up the suicide bombing. But since we don't have any better weapons, then that's the only thing we've got to go with to fight our war of national liberation.
Let's go next to this is Alan. Alan with us from Savannah.
Good afternoon. What is the relationship in the world where there is a conflict between extremists and moderate people, clans, and nations within Islam? And how does that affect us in the United States being caught in the middle of this civil war, particularly around oil? And a second minor question, whatever happened to the word Muslim? I never hear it said anymore. Thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Sure, Alan. First of all, on the question of moderates, I think polls and even just, you know, people like myself or anybody else who goes out and travels in the Middle East rapidly sees the huge number, overwhelming majority of Muslims are moderate in their views, moderate in their interpretation of Islam. They have Christian neighbors. They all anyway accept Jesus as a great prophet. But the problem is that when you have Western armies, American armies in the region, this is a hugely a radicalizing force. It plays into the hands of the radicals. So I would argue that the region has become more superheated, more hysterical, more painful and radicalized than probably God knows since when in history. So that's why I'm advocating, I think, the withdrawal of American military forces and Western military forces as the beginning steps of letting things calm down. You know, I mean, radicals always prosper under terrible conditions. Radicals prosper under war and starvation and hardship and all of these things. When life gets better, moderates tend to do well, and I don't think we will be in the middle. I think people are happy to sell their oil as long as it's at free market prices and not at the sort of bargain basements prices that the West tried to impose on them earlier. On the word Muslim, interesting point. I guess it's part of the modern era in which we're trying now. All countries, all languages are trying to call people by the names that they prefer. We don't say Peking anymore. We say Beijing because the Chinese prefer that. Muslims prefer Muslim, and that's the way they say it in most Muslim languages. So we're accommodating.
How popular were these views when you were vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA?
Well, interestingly, I mean, as you know, we didn't have wars in which American force and military presence was overseas. They were just beginning. I left the CIA 25 years ago. But it was just beginning in the early 80s when you began to have the first suicide bombings against the Marine barracks. But I think people generally understood that you were really asking for trouble if you were to send large military forces in there. There's deep resentment against American military bases. That was actually was Osama bin Laden's first claim and cause was to get American troops out of what he called the holy lands of Saudi Arabia. So those issues do matter a lot, and I think most of us who were professionals in the area knew of these sensitivities. All got blown away after 9/11.
Bases that were installed at the invitation of the Saudis after Saddam Hussein, a Muslim, invaded Muslim Kuwait.
That's correct, but bases were there before then, and there was a special agreement made that under these with the clerics of Saudi Arabia that under very special circumstances, non-Muslim troops are allowed to come in to help kill other Muslims, and this was seen on a strictly temporary basis. But then the U.S. decided to stay on after that war was long over, and indeed expand its bases there. Most people don't like to have foreign bases. I mean, how would we feel if there were Chinese bases or, Pakistani bases or Brazilian bases on American soil with their troops wandering around and having diplomatic immunity from anything they did? It just doesn't sit well.
We're talking with former intelligence official Graham Fuller. His book is A World Without Islam. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation, which is coming to you from NPR News. Let's go next to Mir. Mir with us from Myrtle Beach.
Yes, Mr. Fuller. My question is, what is your theory on if Islam didn't exist, would 9/11 still have happened?
Well, that's, when we get into these what-if questions, it's hard to get specific answers, but I do struggle with that issue a little bit in the book and argue that if you still keep all of these other grievances, the colonialism, the imperialism, the support of foreign, the support of dictators that are not that are hated by the region, efforts to control oil, seize oil, control the price of oil, to invade, to overthrow regimes we don't like, the whole Arab-Israeli problem and ignoring of that issue, one after another, I think you could easily imagine some kinds of radicals in the region deciding to strike back. I mean, as I say, history just doesn't begin with 9/11. So suddenly all of us who were sort of living in the area, working in the area, knew that these pressures were building, the anger, the resentments, pressures, all of this were building. It was really only a matter of time before something snapped and they started taking the war to us. But that was the first time it happened. And that was an incredible shock. And for us, history began with 9/11. But not out there, it didn't.
Mir, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Bharat. Bharat with us from Oakland.
Yes, Mr. Fuller, when you were talking about humanity and the amount of atrocities committed by the Crusaders, you should also include the fact that the Muslims came to India and they massacred and told millions over there. The very well Hindu Kush mountains where they are fighting right now comes from the term used by the Muslims to describe millions of Hindus who died there. So there is a lot of things that you are not mentioning. I mean, I'm not saying this is right or wrong. I'm not a Hindu fanatic by any means. But if we are talking about history, we ought to say that, we have to tell the whole truth, because I can quote to you in India, there are great cities that were pillaged for 6 months by Muslim hordes and burnt and looted and raped and whatever you can think of the Crusaders did, these guys did in India. I think your listeners should know that there is a lot of history behind the animosity towards Muslims, even today in India and Pakistan, as you guys know.
Yeah, well, you raise some really important points there. First of all, do remember the thesis of the book. I'm talking about how much Western relations would be different with the Middle East if there were not an Islam. When you get into the history of Islam and the whole region, then, of course, we are talking about differing religions that have been the flags of empires, including Persia, Persian empires, which were under Zoroastrianism, and then other and Islam and Nestorian Christianity and all of these things. But you're right. I think every ethnic group or religious group in much of the world can point to some very ugly incidents in their history when foreign armies came in and killed and pillaged. But it's interesting to note that in most of the areas where Islam, by the way, spread mostly through trade and missionaries through a long softening up process rather than it was by the sword. In the early days of Islam, Arabs didn't want other people to convert to Islam because they wanted these privileges for themselves. That Islam then changed. But sure, we have to remember too, and you know, sir, as well as anyone, that the fusion of Hindu and Muslim culture in India is one of the high points of Indian history, the Mughal dynasty. I mean, the Taj Mahal, the food, the poetry, the music, all of the stuff that came from this fusion that sometimes had tensions, but also was a very, very close coexistence of Hindu and Muslim in that area. So it's a complex story.
Bharat, thanks very much for the phone call. Thank you. And Graham Fuller, we wanted to thank you for your time.
My pleasure, Neil. It's great to have a chance to air these issues.
Graham Fuller joined us from a studio in Squamish, British Columbia. His book is A World Without Islam, and he's former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the Central Intelligence Agency. Next up, paparazzo Ron Galella managed to capture iconic photos of celebrities such as Jackie Onassis and Marlon Brando during his 50-year career. Now the lens turns on him in a new documentary, Smash His Camera. If you'd like to talk with the famous paparazzo, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. We'd like to hear from photographers. Has Ron Galella influenced your work? Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.